Hello, everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whenever you're watching this podcast. And if you're watching it live with me now in the chat, hi, how's it going? So Zoom has been giving me a bit of a problem. So we're gonna work together with this whole thing. And look, my horned pigtails are back today, so that's very exciting. And hi to everyone that's new to this podcast. This is the Goddess Project podcast. My name is Dr. Carla Ionescu. My PhD is in ancient history. And my focus, my love, my everything is my work on the Goddess Artemis and the Mapping Project. And actually, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the Mapping Project today because I am leaving with my partner, Sandra. Some of you know her. At the end of April, and we're going to be spending May in Northwest Greece, but very exciting, you guys. So we've talked to a couple of museum curators who are going to let us into a couple of spaces that are locked, and I've made a few friends with the museum curators and the few archaeologists in Greece, and they're going to let us behind the museum, behind the museum. Behind the doors in the museum. So hopefully we'll get to photograph some rare pieces, especially around Eritrea. No, I'm lying. Rakita. But you know, who knows when we get there. So I'm very, very, very excited to go. I'm excited to be back in Greece. I'm excited to climb mountains. So I've been in Canada for the last few months, spending the winter here, which is also a little bit tough. And doing a lot of work finishing the Artemis of Ephesus book. I am done. So next week is going to be final edits. And then it goes to an editor, of course, who also does probably better edits than me. And hopefully I should have it available within a couple of months. Then I submit it to the publisher and they do the design, the cover, all that stuff, and then they have it available. So I'm very, very excited, to have all of that going on. But the most exciting thing is the thing that I'd like to share with you. So let me just share my screen. And actually, for those of you that are new here, sorry, I should tell you that this is an unedited podcast. And so there may be some side rants that are going on, especially today, because we're talking about a statue of Ishtar that I have many feelings about. Okay, so there may be some rants, but I don't edit it, and I like it to be just sort of natural conversation style. And for those of you that have been with me since season one, thank you. Thank you. This is so much fun. And I'm so grateful that we get to share this time together and this information together and all of those fun things. So, Zoom is not letting me share my slides as a background slides. Anyways, it's complicated. I'm not very techie. If any of you are super techie, maybe we can talk in the chat about what's going on. Anyway, so I have to do it kind of manually, but I figured this out. Anyway, I put this up here because I am doing a fundraiser for the May expedition. You can use this QR code with your phone and it will take you right to the site. I'm going to do three lectures, so we're going to be live together. I'm going to do three lectures, one in March coming up in 2 weeks, and then two in April. Each of them will be on a site. And I will use original footage, of course, artifacts that I found there, and I'll put a whole lecture together. And then we'll have a Q&A at the end, where we'll discuss anything that's comes up or any questions that you might have. I'm going to do that three times. I'm going to do Eritrea and Amarynthos first. That's where all the exciting archaeological research is being done right now. Then I'm going to do Sardis because I don't think that people talk enough about Sardis in Turkey. This is where the Elafoblia, I'm saying that wrong, the honey cakes traditions took place or was initiated. Well, there was probably honey cakes already, but this was really a famous story where the 300 boys from Samos were kidnapped by the Corinthians, and they were going to be castrated and given to different temples. And anyways, they were rescued by the priests and priestesses and the young people that worshipped at the Temple of Sardis. So anyway, there's lots of adventure stories in that one. So I'm going to show you Sardis because, oh my gosh, it is stunning, stunning. And I had some really interesting experiences there. And then we're going to end with this, which is Artemis's temple, which is the third lecture at Aulis. This is where Iphigenia is said to have been sacrificed by Agamemnon. I'm going to show you the footage and tell you the story of how this is a closed site. So we had to get permission and they had to open the site for us. So I'm very excited to give you footage on this. I'm so excited. This is the first time I'm doing this fundraiser because where we're going and the amount of travel that we have to do to see the temples we've got lined up for May is a little costly. And some of you that are on my Patreon know that things are interesting in the academic field and certainly at the university and the college level and all that fun stuff. So I'm trying this fundraiser thing, but I want to give you something, especially something about the mapping project in exchange for helping to support me. Each of the lectures are $20 each, or $50 for all three lectures. And if you miss it, like if you're like, "Oh, Carla, I can't make that day," that's okay. They will be recorded, and the recordings will be made available after the lecture. So we are all good. So I'm very, very excited, and I hope you're excited. And if you want, you can sign up here, and I'll also put it below in the description. So let's talk the naked truth about this particular statue. So, excuse me, I should give you a little bit of background about how I came to this statue, actually. So my friend and I were in the British Museum, and I've been to the British Museum many times, and I've seen the statue several times, actually. And her name is Karen, and she's wonderful. And she lives, I think, just outside of Liverpool. I hope I'm saying that right, Karen. And we were walking and we were looking at it, and she read the label, which we're going to talk about in a minute. And she was like, this sounds really unflattering. It sounds really terrible. And at first we were like, where's the inscription on the back, which I'm going to show you in a minute. And then we found the inscription. And then we just continued talking about it, and it sort of stayed with us because the inscription didn't sound right, and the, I don't know, the whole tone of it all. So the question that really came up is, how does the British Museum know the intention of the purpose of the statue? And apparently there were many like this statue. We just found the one. How do they know with such authority to put this label up there? And my friend Karen and I, we fell down this rabbit hole where she was sending me stuff and I was reading, like, you know, she's like, "Well, I looked this up and look at this." And then she's like, "I looked this up," and I'm like, "Okay, this has to be a podcast episode because this Assyrian statue needs way more TV time, way more exposure. And the British Museum really needs to, I'm going to tag them in all my promos. It re they really need to reassess the label for this statue. So we're going to talk about, and remember when I did the episode on how labels in museums are so important because people are coming to the museum, all of us, and you can't know everything about every room and every piece and every artifact in the museum. So it's very important that the labels are accurate, that they're, you know, non-biased as much as possible, that they're updated. And there's like there seems to be a very intense hold on this label for this statue. It's like the British Museum doesn't want to admit that perhaps they're wrong about the way that this is labeled, or even their understanding about the statue of Ishtar. And so I thought, well, let's talk about it, right? Let's just talk about it and see what happens. So let's begin by, oops, sorry, hold on. Yeah, Zoom is sometimes giving me a problem. So this is the Assyrian statue in question. She's called the Last Woman Standing, and she is an Assyrian limestone statue from Nineveh, dating back to the reign of King Ashurbelkala, 1073 to 1056 BCE, before the Common Era. Now, this artifact is housed at the British Museum, like we've talked about, and it depicts a naked woman. This is a rare depiction in Assyrian art. That is, Assyrians didn't tend to depict their women naked, but it's one that raises lots of questions about power, gender, historical interpretation. Now, in ancient Mesopotamia, sometime between 1073 and 1056, King Ashurbelkala, who titled himself the King of the Universe, Strong King, King of Assyria, very humble, did something that by modern standards may seem pretty strange. So he erected nude statues, we think for the goddess Ishtar, at Nineveh, which is modern day Mosul, Iraq, in Iraq, expressively for the purpose of titillation. This is where the word, or this is where the controversy begins. Okay. Now, it is my argument and the argument of several scholars that he wanted his subjects to admire the view, to admire the beauty of the naked female body. And I'm going to give you all the evidence I have for this argument. The artifact stands approximately 97 centimeters tall and 47 centimeters wide. She's about 5 feet tall and she's about 2, 3 feet wide. So she's shorter than I am. I'm 5 foot 7. And then she's got a small 27 set or 28 centimeter waist. But what's truly striking is the full nudity of this female figure, which is, like I said, unlike Assyrian art and Assyrian depiction of women tends to have them mostly covered up. Of course, later Greek statues and Roman statues had lots of naked or half-naked women, but Assyrian art tended to drape their female figures. They tended to be a little bit more conservative. However, nudity was okay, particularly for divine figures, and of course, particularly for Ishtar, the goddess of love and war and fertility. And one of the most interesting aspects of this statue is the pubic area. So while this seems like a minor detail, there is, in a culture that has very little female nudity, there is explicit, you can't really see it here, but there is explicit like pubic hair in this area. So this is a very important detail, and I think it blends into my argument for why this would have been put on there and why this was a statue or a presentation for enjoyment. Okay, so definitely not about shaming, definitely not about embarrassment, and certainly not about mockery. Now, this statue was unearthed in 1853 by British archaeologist Harmazd Rassam near the Temple of Ishtar in Nineveh. So it's interesting that they have a statue of Ishtar, a naked statue. Well, let's go. A naked statue is what they originally said, because it doesn't have the name Ishtar on it. But it's in front of the temple of the goddess Ishtar. And one of the arguments is that it is unlikely that the king would have put a naked female statue in a from a, coming from a religion in which Ishtar plays a key role as a goddess of fertility, beauty, sex, etc., in order to mock that statue. And then our understanding, of course, is that the other statues that he had made, which are sort of duplicates of this statue, were placed around in other temple sites. So this strengthens the argument that actually this is not an object of mockery, but it is an intentional divine representation of Ishtar. Okay. So, because why would anybody mock a woman in front of the temple of Ishtar, a female divinity, right? So it doesn't seem like something that the Assyrians were known for, and certainly they didn't seem to enjoy doing that in other places or other things. So again, we have very little very little information or very little evidence that they would do something like that. So here is the inscription on the back. It's kind of hard to see when you're in the museum, but easily photographed and translated. So I've given you here two translations. Okay, so for those of you that are listening to me, I'm going to read it to you. In 1902, this was the very first English translation of cuneiform. And Budge, who is one of the scholars working on this, has this translation, and it says it's broken. So if it doesn't make sense, it's okay. The palace of Ashurbelkala, the king of hosts, the mighty king, the king of Assyria, the son of Tiglath-Pileser, and king of hosts, the king of Assyria. So okay, there's a lot about him. The son of Ashur-Reshishi, the king of hosts, the king of Assyria. Okay. These among the rulers of cities and dot 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 upon dot 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 have I think whosoever shall alter my inscription or my name which is written therein may the god Za'a, okay, we'll talk about that in a minute, and the gods of the land of Martu smite him with smiting. So Budge's 1902 English translation of this cuneiform says nothing about embarrassing, shaming, mocking. This is what the original label of the British Museum was based on. But as you see, it's got nothing. Then Albert Kirk Grayson in 1991, so 90 years later and about 30 years ago, is that right? Yeah, that's about right. Created a more complete translation of the cuneiform. And it says this. Property of the palace of Assurbelkala, king of the universe, strong king, king of Assyria, son of Tiglath-Pileser, king of the universe, strong king, king of Assyria, son of Assur-Resa-Ishi, I who was also king of the universe, strong king, king of Assyria, I made these sculptures in the provinces, cities, and garrisons for titillation or enjoyment. As for the one who removes my inscriptions and my name, the divine Sibiti, the gods of the West, will afflict him with a snake bite. So I have a couple of things to say about this. Number one, of course, being it's very, very clear that these are that as we say that right, Carla. It's very, very clear that as we move forward in time, we understand cuneiform and we understand Assyrian culture, Babylonian culture, all of the cultures that used Sumerian cultures that use cuneiform much more and more better, much, much better. Anyway, and in doing that allows us to translate what we see a lot better. And actually, in after the podcast today, we're going to go over cuneiform tablets together. They're so much fun. Anyway, we'll get to that later. So we have discovered more and more and more tablets or pieces of tablets with different writing. And you know, that allows you a much more comprehensive understanding of the language. So I have no doubt that Albert Kirk Grayson in 1991 did his very, very best to translate. In fact, I have no doubt that even Budge in 1902 did his very best to translate this. But it's the titillation. Right? It's the titillation. Now, titillation, no matter how you define it, titillation is also to entice, to enjoy, to attract. None of that has to do with mockery. None of that. And so it seems like the bias, certainly the bias by the British Museum and its labels, comes from that Victorian perspective, that really ancient colonizer perspective, that when they found this statue, and they sort of read the bits and pieces of it, what they could translate at the time. They thought, oh, for sure, this is just a shaming of women, a public shaming of women. And they never reconsidered it. Okay. And in fact, when they've been pressured to reconsider it, they refuse to do so. So I really want you to think about how important labels are, right? So these are the labels that I'm talking about. So this is the label, and we're going to look at the letter by Colleen Hessling, which Hesslin, I hope I'm saying her name right, which really started this podcast. to be honest. Because once I saw this and I read her letter, I was like, oh, hell no. Hell no. So this is in 2016, guys, 10 years ago. This is the label, as you can see here, before 2016. I'm going to read that to you. And then the one after her letter in 2019. And I'm going to ask you if there's much of a difference. So before 2016, the British Museum has this massive label right behind a statue, and it says, "The Last Woman Standing. King Ashurbelkala sent versions of this unflattering statue all around his kingdom." I don't know what's unflattering. Okay, we'll leave that up for a conversation in the chat. "This is the only known example to have survived and is remarkable for the total nudity it displays, including pubic hair. The king says in the inscription on her lower back that he did this to provoke a reaction." Okay. "The text does not fully explain what his motive was, but presumably everybody who saw one understood." Everybody who saw one understood. Okay. "A humorous curse threatens anyone who tampers with the inscription with a snake bite." That's true. So this is before the Colleen Hessling letter. Okay. Colleen Hessling, I'm going to read you her letter. It's not very long, and I'm going to read you the reply of the British Museum. My gosh. Okay. I'm just thinking if I should read the letter first. Okay. And then show you the, share with you the 2019. But let me read it. So after her letter, the British Museum gave in a little bit. And now the label reads like this. And this is the label that I saw this summer. "The Last Woman Standing. King Ashurbelkala sent versions of this statue." So they took out unflattering. Oh, wow. "All around his kingdom in an elaborate and expensive act of victimization." So you see how they still keep that dig? How is it a victimization? "This is the only known example remaining and shows a completely naked woman." Notice they took out the pubic hair here. "In the inscription on her lower back, the king suggests that people who saw the statue would know who it was meant to be and laugh at her expense." It doesn't say that at all. Doesn't say that at all in the translation. "The type of stone chosen, the way the woman stands and her nakedness match the inscription's tone of mocking derision." In fact, I'm going to argue that this new label is even worse because it implies that people are meant to mock this naked woman. It implies that it's not a divine figure. It implies all of these aspects. Okay. So, in fact, I think the British Museum's new label is even more worse, and we're going to talk about that. But let me first read you the letter. So, Colleen Hesslin from Vancouver, BC to Canada, wrote an open letter, so you can find it online, to the British Museum on March 3rd. Oh, March. That's amazing. 2016. I've read this letter a couple of times. I didn't even pay attention to the date. And it says, "To whom it may concern, I was recently visiting the British Museum in February 2016. And came across a remarkable statue, The Last Woman Standing. I am interested in more information on the title and background of the statue. If you could provide me with any relevant historical and academic text that referenced this statue, I would greatly appreciate it. I have done some basic online research and I've come across a limited amount of information. Most importantly, the recent translation of the inscription on the lower back on this work from 1991, the one that I've read to you. And some descriptive notes in the British Museum online archive. However, the title of the work, The Last Woman Standing, does not seem to follow the statue in other texts and references. It seems only to exist on the wall didactic in the museum." That's true. After reading the wall didactic, so the first one before 2016, that accompanies this statue, I was left with more questions than answers. And upon further research, I found some of the British Museum wall text contradictory to other brief sources easily available. Could you provide me the name of the author and date of the didactic text? My suspicion is that the didactic text is old, perhaps poorly translated, and simply needs to be revisited and updated with current and more accurate references." And then she inserts the translation. Okay. And she inserts the label, the original label that says the unflattering statue. She then says, in your own online database, it says lime statue of a woman carved a cuneiform inscription on the back states that the king erected it for the enjoyment of the people. Much of the surfaces are lost, but the details of the pubic hair are carefully carved. So she points out in 2016, the British Museum's own hypocrisy, own contradiction, because they had that big label up that you see here, which talked about an unflattering statue. And then online, if you looked online in their database, they talked about how this was for the enjoyment. Then she goes on to compare the 1902 Budge translation with Grayson's translation in 1991. Then she says, the main contradiction that I'm finding in the wall didactic, the label, the didactic means the label, is the description of the statue as unflattering and made for a purpose by the king. However, that purpose is unknown and was but was understood by the Assyrian people. This vague reference to the inscription is uninformative, and the public would be more accurately informed to read the current translated inscription in its place. And even though the museum's own database says that the king erected it for the enjoyment of the people, I find it curious that this is not on the public wall of the museum. So your own label online is contradicting the larger label or didactic, as she calls it, behind the statue. And then she talks about coming across some of the work of Amy Rebecca Gansel, who talks about Neo-Assyrian ideal feminine beauty. She did some research on Assyrian cultural values relating to beauty. And she talks about how Gansel, the scholar, says that Assyrian statues of nude female figures, right? And voluptual, you know, the voluptual female ideals of the time were not something that was made fun of, but was actually something that was related to fertility. So what she's saying here is scholarship is clearly saying no one laughed at naked statues in Assyrian culture. In fact, naked statues, if there were any, or if they were rare, were about fertility. And so she says, then she says, as an institution that is currently battling several reparation requests. So think about how long the British Museum has held items that they colonized. A whole rant is on that. So, as an institution, the British Museum, that is currently battling several reparation requests and calling itself an appropriate custodian, in quotes, her quotes, I would hope that the museum take an active stand in accurately, professionally, and objectively representing the artifacts that you hold and present to the public. I would also encourage the museum to take reparation requests seriously, as every request that is rightfully honored, the collection may shrink, but its public perception will grow in a favorable light. Okay. My suggestion is that the wall didactic be updated. This is 2016. Removing the description of the figure statue as unflattering and adding the most recent translation of the description on the statue's lower back. This information would be good. Thank you very much. Blah, blah, blah. March 16th, she receives a letter. So, right away, not bad, 2016, she receives a letter from, like I said, Irvin Finkel, the museum curator and an archaeologist himself. Oof, are you ready for this? Okay, I'm just gonna. Dear madam, I write in reply to your open letter sent by email to this museum, which has been passed to me as one of the two curators responsible for the new display in the later Mesopotamian gallery in which the Assurbanipal statue has been displayed. The wording in the British Museum database notes that you quote, refers to the enjoyment of the people. Okay. This derives from the second published translation that you've quoted by Professor Grayson in 1991. And Professor Grayson's translation says titillation, titillation, enjoyment. Okay. The word in the original Assyrian cuneiform text, Ayanu, a verb which carries a range of nuances as follows. So he's being super condescending. To laugh, to smile, to be alluring, to act coquettishly and to be anxious. None of that says mockery, though, just saying that. The translations of enjoyment or titillation each carry their own specific implication, neither of which seem to us, in preparing the display and its labeling, to be in keeping with the Mesopotamian ideas in general. Like, really? You know everything about Mesopotamian ideas in general. Wow. Or the interpretation of this statue. The following points seem to us significant. The condescension, I just want you to understand. This man is basically telling her, I'm going to tell you the way I see this interpretation, and I don't actually care of all the other complex nuances. And I know everything there is to know about Mesopotamia, so whatever. He says the following points seem to us significant. Stone to produce a statue of this size was extremely costly. Right. Why would they do that just to mock a statue of a woman? Okay. The cuneiform inscription said, and he does this in italics, so he really points that out. The cuneiform inscription says that examples of the statue were made for the king, for the provinces, cities, and garrisons, so lots of them. No one can be sure how many this might have involved, but such a national operation was evidently huge. So you telling me this king made a ton of these statues that were expensive so people could laugh at naked women? There is no other case of a statue being duplicated for distribution throughout the kingdom, and the expense, labor, and transport implied means that this was something quite extraordinary in every way. Yes, to honor Ishtar. Yeah. The king who calls himself the king of the universe would not have made fun of Ishtar by putting these statues naked in front of her temples so people could laugh at them. It's completely illogical. Nude three-dimensional sculpture of a woman is likewise an exceptional rarity throughout Mesopotamian history. That's bullshit. That's not true. I mean, imagine Mesopotamian history. That's 3,000 years. Okay? He's talking nonsense, especially with all the details picked out with such clarity. And so this gives a specific impression of a specific incident and specific, and who wants a specific response. And I only got two more paragraphs left, but I'm starting to be really furious. While ancient concepts of beauty, so this is a white British male talking about Assyrian, Middle Eastern, Mesopotamian concept of female beauty, like an expert. Okay, just putting that out there. While ancient concepts of beauty are not necessarily easy to grasp, we are, of course, not blind to the fact that ancient cultures are remote and ancient cultures. Okay. But we have a great deal of evidence from Mesopotamian art that beauty in women can never have been exemplified in this statue. We do not. I'll show you that in a minute. Perhaps you will disagree. Yes. I disagree 10 years later, Irvin Finkel. But then ultimately, this is a matter of personal taste. So if some of you out there have larger YouTube channels or newsletters, can you please add this video? Because I need the British Museum to come to the table. Like, I need them to have this discussion. Ultimately, this is a matter of personal taste. His personal taste dictates the label for everyone who visits the British Museum and envelops a generalization about the ideals of beauty for Mesopotamian, Assyrian, Middle Eastern culture. The arrogance, the misogyny. But against the backdrop of Mesopotamian statuary and likeness, on all scales, this statue is unquestionably unflattering, as it is coarsely finished, heavy, lumpen, distorted, and reminiscent of an ape. I'd like to reread to you that. But give me a minute. Perhaps you will disagree then, ultimately. But then ultimately, this is a matter of personal taste, his personal taste. Against a backdrop of Mesopotamian statuary and likenesses, on all scales, this statue is unquestionably unflattering as it is coarsely finished, heavy, lumpen, distorted, and reminiscent of an ape. He goes on to say, Grayson's 1991 translation of the word titillation has seemed to us highly inappropriate, that he has a highly inappropriate motive for this complex operation. Maybe he has a schoolboy reaction to nudity. Grayson is a scholar, archaeologist in his own right, PhD, everything, expert, everything. But Finkel from the British Museum goes, oh, maybe he's using that word because he has a schoolboy reaction to nudity, which simply is wholly out of key with everything we know. Well, he knows everything from the cuneiform world. Much more probable is that the statue was to provoke ridicule, where everyone would recognize who was represented and hoot in derision. He says this is why it's reinforced by the curse, which says if anybody damages or touches this statue, a snake bite will bite them, will be their curse. Right? We have many such formulas on conventional works in stone. And this strikes a bizarre but therefore comic response. So we have other evidence that other statues have such a warning, don't touch it or something will happen to you. But for this one, we've decided it's comic. That's probably comic. Haha. In conclusion, we cannot do anything about it. Okay. And therefore, you know, we cannot know what promoted this production and distribution of the statues. And so we're not going to change the label. I hope this answers your inquiry. Yours truly, Irvin Finkel, Dr. I.L. Finkel, Assistant Keeper, Department of the Middle East of the British Museum. And then it gets even more fun. Colleen Hessling says that on May 13, a couple of months later, no, May 13, 2019, 3 years later, 3 years later, she received a personal email of an employee of the British Museum who chose to remain anonymous. And this employee says, Dear Colleen, you don't know me, but we have an interest in common. The label given to the statue called the Last Woman Standing at the British Museum. I came across your open letter in 2016, and I wholly agree with your viewpoint. You will, I hope, be pleased to know, as I was at the museum recently and replaced the older, oh, sorry, as I was at the museum recently, and the museum has replaced the older, unflattering card with a more balanced analysis of this statue and the meaning behind it. I attached a photo. The progress. The wheels grind small, but they grind. Thank you for your work. All the best wishes. So, the second one that I have here for you is the 2019. Okay. So, the first one says it's unflattering, right? And includes pubic hair, and that the text does not fully explain his motive. Okay. But the second one, after 2019, I'm going to say that this is even worse because, yes, they took out the unflattering. So, they said, King Ashurbanipal sends versions of the statue all around his kingdom, an elaborate and expensive act of victimization. That's Irving Finkel's bias. We don't know that. That's not in the inscription. This is the only known example, shows a completely naked woman. They took out the whole pubic hair situation. In the inscription on the lower back, it suggests that people who saw the statue would know what it was meant to and laugh at her expense. It does not suggest that in the inscription, neither the 1902 translation nor the 1991 translation. The type of stone chosen, the way the woman stands in her nakedness, match the inscription's tone of mocking derision. So I actually think that this is even worse. This doesn't even talk about the curse. It doesn't say anything. So let me say this to the British Museum. Just put the dang inscription on this label. This didactic, this is a big piece right behind her. Just put the inscription and be quiet. No interpretation is necessary. Or perhaps write something else, you know, that with several different views on this interpretation and let people make that decision for themselves. So it is infuriating, as you can probably tell. I don't normally get this heated. And I thought that I would show you some Mesopotamian, my own Mesopotamian collections of Mesopotamian artifacts. So when we talk about Mesopotamia, we're talking about 3,000 to 5,000 years. We're talking about a massive, massive area, geographical area. I mean, I can't imagine someone, what's the word I'm looking for, making these widespread assumptions, especially when we have all this data. So first I'm going to show you a little video, and then I'm going to show you some specific statues so that you can see for yourself. And then I'm going to give you a little bit of timeline so you have an understanding. Okay, but you could see for yourself that naked women, particularly with little pubic hair in the pubic area, is not unusual. It is not derisive. No one was laughing. People had them in their homes. People had them in their burial sites. They were sacred. They were important, highly prized. Like, okay, let me play you this short. So this is an overall, let me see if this will play. Hold on. And this is just one, like I said, one part of the museum. There are about six of these. Full of women. I mean, look at the pubic hair, right? Very, very clear, very, very purposely done. These are small, small pieces, yes. And we'll talk about all the dates, but lots and lots of them, hundreds, if not thousands of them have been found. Okay. So many of them have been found. And the women can be covered or uncovered in this way. So it is a little bit annoying. So I thought that I would show you, let me show you the way that we think about. So these are the representations, mostly of men and then of some women during the period that we're talking about. So 1650 to 750 BCE. So we are talking about around 1000 BCE, right? So this is what we're talking about here. And we are mostly used to this depiction of men, certainly covered. And this woman here on the side, you can kind of see that she's got this covering over here, right? But let me show you all of these women, right? So all of these women, it is true these are about 600 years before this king, but these are all inspiration. These are old Babylonian, Mesopotamian. So what is Finkel talking about when he's talking about, oh, this is a very rare depiction? What are you talking about? Look at these. I've just picked a few here for you. I mean, the Assyrians and let's say the Mesopotamians, although we shouldn't say it quite like that, because that's a lot of cultures and times, did not shy away from sex, did not shy away from sexual expression, did not see anything wrong with sexuality, did not have any issues with seeing naked women in the sense of like these kinds of representations. Not that women were walking around naked, but there was no, this kind of Victorian conservatism is a bias imposed on that culture, okay? And so it's very clear. He's talking about, you know, we don't have artifacts that matched. We have a ton. Okay, we don't have more of these massive statues. We just found this one, but we have a ton of figurines of figure, especially around Ishtar, Inanna, all of these goddesses that, yes, sometimes they're fully clothed in armor and they've got their swords and arrows behind them, but sometimes they're also depicted in this way. So absolutely zero basis for what he's saying. Zero. And so I thought I would take you a little bit through Assyrian sexuality and the Assyrian sexuality of women. Okay. So ancient Assyria, like I said earlier, was absolutely not reserved when it came to the discussion of sex and erotica. Lots of their poetry, music, and art has erotica in it and has sexuality in it. So the fact that the king would have commissioned these naked statues to be placed in public spaces around the city and in front of the Temple of Ishtar absolutely fits into the cultural norms. Okay. And what's really fascinating, and I don't know where Finkel did his homework, but I'm sure he didn't really read much of modern interpretations and modern research. And in fact, I shouldn't even say that because this was available for a long time, this information. Anyways, so the Assyrians had this belief that the nude female form has supernatural powers. Okay, so come with me on this knowledge. The naked female form has supernatural powers. In Assyrian thought, plaques, statues, other sacred objects were not just decorative, but had spiritual significance, and they could act as portals between the physical and the metaphysical world. And they had this idea that the vagina, okay, is the source of supernatural power linked to sexual experience, but also to transcendent states of wonder. So then that fits really well with the idea that the vagina, the pubic area, was highlighted on this statue. Okay. Because it's true. I mean, Finkel's right about one thing. The Assyrians walking around looking at these statues would have understood what that meant. But it was not derision, and it was certainly not mockery. Okay. It was pure enjoyment and pure spiritual understanding. They would have understood the power of looking at the naked form. So you won't be surprised that so many Western male scholars, and even female scholars, but so many Western male scholars misinterpreted the prevalence of human nudes in Near Eastern art. And they reduced them to symbols of fertility and good luck. Okay. But they were not actually grounded in true Mesopotamian cultural studies, but were very much a reflection or imposition of Western thought. So, Professor Zanaib Bahrani, sorry if I'm saying your name wrong, does a lot of work on Assyrian nude statues. And these interpretation, their research shows that, in fact, Assyrian nude statues differed significantly from prehistoric nude statues. Prehistoric nude statues tended to emphasize childbearing and fertility, like, for example, when we think about Kaiba Li, when we think about the Venus of Waldendorf. I mean, we're talking about here Neolithic and early statues. But for the Assyrians, the naked female body. So we've got a complete misunderstanding of Assyrian view on sexuality. Okay. And like I said earlier, the idea is that the female nude body, remember, let me put my thoughts together. The female nude body is an object of male desire and pleasure. Okay. So Dr. Bahrani says, concerned with the image of the woman, not as a mother, as a reproductive agent, but one who is an object of male sexual desire and pleasure. So what I'm saying here is that it was very much in the norm to have a nude depiction of a woman for male enjoyment as they walked around. Not mockery, not derision. And what's really fascinating, so I'm using the burning relief up here behind me, which is sometimes identified with Ishtar, Inanna, Lilith, right? This goddess that stands between owls, and she stands on lions, and she's often referred to as a female, as an example of female sexuality, power, etc. Yeah. But I don't know that anybody has talked about the Assyrian erotic poetry, where Ishtar herself is portrayed as a sexually dominant goddess. So I pulled this piece of this poem from Ishtar Will Not Tire, okay, from Bahrani's work. And let me read to you a few lines of the poem. It says, "Get all the young men of your city together. The city is built on pleasure. Let's go to the shade of the wall. The city is built on pleasure. Seven for her midriff, seven for her loins. The city is built on pleasure. 60, then 60 satisfy themselves in turn upon her nakedness. The city is built on pleasure. Young men have tired. Ishtar will not tire. The city is built on pleasure." So that's, so that's a lot about sexual satisfaction. And it's an aspect, a foundational aspect of the city itself. It's a bit, so to our modern, in our modern view, it's a bit creepy because it implies a great orgy of men with Ishtar. Of course, this is a chant, a poem, and so it's not literal, but it implies this idea that the city is built on pleasure, and Ishtar is unapologetically assertive. She commands the men to satisfy her. They need to satisfy her. She's almost, sort of always sort of unsatisfied. She can go, what's the word? What's the word I'm looking for? When she just doesn't get enough of sexuality. And so she's seen as the sort of powerful divine source of pleasure. Part of that makes me feel but as evidence for the fact that this would not have been derision, I'm adding it in here. Yeah. There are lots and lots of erotic themes in religious and literary contexts. However, that being said, real Assyrian women's lives were m much more restricted. Okay. So there was a lot of, there's, and so for example, in the Middle Assyrian laws and the palace edicts, which are recorded on cuneiform tablets, we do see very harsh punishments for any perceived transgression of sexual norms. So if you are seen talking to a woman or looking at a palace woman, you could be killed. So interestingly, well, maybe that's not interestingly, maybe that makes sense because the women, so the law says, for example, if a palace woman and the man are standing by themselves with no third person with them, whether they're behaving in a flirtation manner or not, they shall be killed. Okay. And then bystanders were encouraged to report that kind of stuff. So there was an extreme policing of women's bodies. Okay. And but behind that, there's this tone that women's bodies had supernatural potency. And that made them objects of desire. You're not surprised, right? For example, there's this Middle Assyrian sex omen that says, if a man repeatedly stares at his woman's vagina, his health will be good. He will lay his hands on whatever is not his. So that's a way of saying he'll get lots of things, right? If a man is with a woman and while facing him, she repeatedly stares at his penis, whatever he finds will not be secure in his home. So basically, it is more important. A man will be successful if he stares at his woman's genitals, but if the woman stares at his genitals, not so much. So there's this idea that staring at a woman's genitals brings you luck. You'll have all the things you don't have yet. And so this, again, I'm not trying to say that the Assyrians were non-misogynist or that they didn't have very patriarchal views. Of course they did. What I'm saying, though, is that the men were very comfortable with this idea. They had this belief that number one, staring at a woman's body is for their pleasure, naked women, a deity, not not a woman woman because those women were sheltered, but a deity's body like Ishtar was for their pleasure and their luck. Number two, staring at a woman's pubic area brings them good luck. So the act of gazing at a woman's genitals would actually rub off and bring you good luck. So this statue was not meant to liberate women in any way, okay? But it was not a pornographic object either, because pleasure was intended to be seen as male, as a type of male, as a medium to male prosperity. So they had this belief that female nudity, particularly deity female nudity, but even your own wife in your own private bedroom, like rubbed on you this good luck, right? That the beauty of the female body, nude body, somehow magically allowed you to absorb prosperity. Does that make sense? So, while the patriarchy disturbs me, coming back to this statue, it's very, very clear that the king, I mean, this seems to me much more convincing that the king would then, who sees himself as the king of the universe, would then put statues all over his city for all the men who were mostly outside, because women, again, were quite sheltered, to absorb this luck, right? So erotic energy benefits men. Pleasurable viewing benefits men. Yeah. This is the way it works in patriarchal societies anyway, but for the purpose of this statue, yeah. Sexual pleasure, visual pleasure, was integral to Assyrian culture. It wasn't shameful. And in fact, if you think about a culture like this, a culture in that believes that staring at a woman's body and staring at her pubic area actually brings you luck, if Irvin Finkel understood just this basic concept, why would he ever think, besides the fact that's not even in the inscription, because certainly that didn't deter him, why would he even think that the king would then spend so much money to make naked statues of women for people to make fun of? It's ludicrous. It's pure colonizer, British, male, Victorian, conservatism. Bias, but also stubbornness and denial, because this material is freely available. If you want to read Dr. Behrani's work, Sex in the Realm of the Woman, and lots of other Assyrian work, send me a message. I'll send you some links. I mean, this is not, what I mean is that anyone in the field has lots of this information available to them. So it's not the Assyrian concept of sexuality is not a secret. Yes, it is complex, right? So it's not just repression and liberation. It's a complex way. You have to sort of open your mind to contextualize the culture itself. But it's not hard, is what I'm saying. It's not difficult, and a scholar should be able to easily do it. And then I thought I'd share with you some later figurines and figures and statues that became widely popular, that were, I believe, sort of inspired by the same sort of female nudity. So what you he see here is Dr. Stephanie Langen Hooper. She writes extensively about the late Seleucid and early Parthian period. I'm sorry, I'm a little bit blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Because I'm so irked at the absurdity of Finkel that sometimes that affects what I'm talking about. So these pieces here that you've seen are the alabaster figure, for example, of Ishtar Aphrodite, which is one of the most recognizable artifacts of this time. And it's got these ruby eyes and it's very, very beautiful. But lots of other terracotta versions and alabaster figurines were made, and most likely they were expensive, and so therefore they were for the elite. And sort of this Ishtar Aphrodite blend, right, of cultural development. So here we're entering the 2nd century BCE. So about, 800 years, 500 to 800 years later, after this statue, which you see here on the far right corner of Assyria. But the shape and the figure and the association of this naked female body remains very much the same. So what I'm saying is that as the Greeks are, sorry, as we move forward through time and we're passing through other Greek and Babylonian influences that are sort of blending, the shape, the celebration of Ishtar, even as she blends with Aphrodite, remains very much the same. So here is a sort of later argument that says that the shape of this nude figure is very much in line with the way that cultures over time saw prosperity around this goddess, Ishtar and Aphrodite. The fact that Finkel says, so you can see the statue here on the far right, the fact that Finkel says that this statue looks like an ape, like an ape. And we see a bunch of Ishtar Aphrodite with similar figures, again, is infuriating and absurd. And so I thought that I would show you some examples of the fact that this shape continues to be held in high regard, right? It's almost like this is pretty much the hourglass shape. I mean, I don't even understand what the heck he's talking about here when he's talking about this might look like an ape. It's so insulting that the words are, right? These statues later on, they have all kinds of interpretations that they were used for sexual agency, that they were used to increase fertility, that they were used as a symbol of beauty and power. We found so many of them across this geographical space and time that they seem to have numerous issues, numerous uses, but none of them, not one of them, is mockery or derision. Not one. Not one. And so I thought that you could kind of see this evidence so clearly, and I'm sure that you can. All the while, the British Museum continues to have this terrible label still up there. And no one has yet challenged it in the last decade. Perhaps this is the challenge. I'm going to tag the British Museum here, and I'm going to tag the British Museum everywhere. Because of all the things that we've talked about in the last hour. Yeah. So I thought that I would leave you with this poem of Ishtar, the Queen of Heaven, particularly around her power around sexuality, but also her guide in the afterlife. So we're talking about a phenomenal goddess, and her ability to revive the dead. No one but she can bring back the ones who reveres her from the grave. No one but she can revive the dead and restore them. And so we're talking about a goddess who embodies sexuality, fertility, war, battle, beauty, and the resurrection of the dead. And this dude, this Irving Finkel from the British Museum, has decided that this statue placed in front of her temple by a culture he clearly does not understand was so that people could laugh and mock women's nakedness. So I hope that you can kind of see why we were baffled, yeah, and why we went down this rabbit hole, especially after I read Colleen's letter, and especially after I read the before and after, which didn't seem any better, didn't seem any better. And so I thought that I would take this on. And so I hope that you've enjoyed this podcast. If you'd like to join me after the podcast, which is on my Patreon, if you'd like to join me, I'm going to talk about some of the tablets. Where am I? I'm in the way. And Tales of Ancient Babylonia. So at the Chicago Museum, the ISAC Museum, we were there, I don't know, last year. You could see me here taking pictures, just in awe. So much Babylonian Assyrian, so much Mesopotamian, such a large collection here. But the cuneiforms is hilarious because they found so many pieces. And so we're going to talk, we're going to look at what students were writing about. We're going to look at curses. We're going to look at the way that they wrote about the gods. And so we're going to have some fun. The translations are already up there and we're going to go through some of them and I'm going to talk a little bit about them. So if you don't know what After the Podcast is, it's just a short half an hour, usually a video that goes up on Patreon. And if you don't want to sign up for a monthly Patreon, they're also sold individually. So you could pick whichever one you like. Again, this is another effort to raise funds for the mapping project and the Artemis project and all of those things. So I hope that you'll be able to join me in after the podcast. But if not, I want to thank you for joining me here and for spending time with me. And I hope that you are as intrigued and perhaps infuriated as I am about this statue. And I hope that you have a fantastic weekend. And I will see you all next time. Bye all. Thank you so much. Bye.